Please be seated, and Mitch, would you come for our third talk?
All right, so remember where we've been. We've just recapped real quickly. We're talking about objections to the faith, and the three main ones we've seen are, you know, is belief in God irrational, or the objection is not is it, it is irrational. Then science has shown that God doesn't exist, and then evil and suffering have shown that God doesn't exist. We're in the second one now. We talked about Galileo, and that's really crucial for you to understand just how Galileo is being used to push against Christianity and religion in general from this notion that, you know, science is showing us that God doesn't exist, that belief in God is irrational, and all of that. So now what we want to do is we want to talk about Newton. Newton is another character, and if I had to say, look, you got to know the story of two people in history when it comes to the sciences, it's going to be Galileo and Newton. These are just so strategic, but they not only show you, they're not only strategic culturally, they're strategic when it comes to teaching us about science. Okay, so knowing about Galileo and Newton will also teach us how to think about science, not just what it was like, but also what it's like now. So these are high-yield folks. You know, I mean, and this is one of the things. I don't want you to think that, you know, these are just little niceties, you know, little sketches that are kind of nice to know, you know, a little bit about Galileo, a little bit about Newton, and this is just for interest. These are crucial. These are not luxuries. These are things that we need to really start instilling in our kids. No, so they know this history, and they know, and not just for the purpose of apologetics or defending their faith, but just so they know science, so they know philosophy. Our kids should be the best philosophers, the best scientists, the best mathematicians, and they need to know this stuff. So anyways, we need to be recapturing that, and this is part of my argument for that. Okay, Newton. One of the things that, again, people are often surprised that Newton was a very devout Christian, which is interesting. I mean, why, you know, because most people don't know really anything about Newton other than that he was a scientist and that he's important in science, that he may be the most important scientist. Why would that automatically cause people to be surprised that he's a Christian? Again, there's been this story, and this really the story didn't start to get told in this fashion until maybe the late 1800s, that there's this inherent animosity between belief in God and science. So most of us know about Newton, you know, kind of in cartoon form. You see an apple falling on his head, you know, bounces off his head. He discovers, he's discovered gravity. I mean, people already knew that apples fall and all of that. So that's not really, it didn't really go down like that. It's a lot more complicated. It took him a lot more time. And by the way, he did not discover gravity. People knew about it before him. But here's the thing. He basically, and this is one of the reasons he's so important, he basically culminated the entire Greek philosophical endeavor. So, and we'll talk about this, the Greeks had this goal, starting back with Plato and even before. They had this goal. Here's what we want to do. Newton does it. He's the one that ends up completing this goal. And we'll talk about what that goal is in a bit. By the way, he wrote, this guy wrote so much. I mean, it's amazing how much he wrote. And he wrote far more on theology and religion than he did on science. Science just comprised only a small fraction of his writings. I think he should be one, by the way, I think he should be one of our heroes of the faith. We should know more about this guy. I will give you a character sketch because I do think it's important to show where he's coming from. He was born 1642. That was the, remember my little mnemonic that I taught you? You guys know. Now he was born after Galileo. King, that helped you to remember. He was born the year that Galileo died. His father died before he was born. He started out pretty rough life. They thought he was going to die within hours of his birth. The nurses, they were sent to town to get some help. They figured he wasn't going to survive, so they rested on the way. Turns out, he's this little premature baby, ends up surviving, ends up being this really, he was kind of fragile, but he ended up being slowly growing into this really, really tough dude. He was a tough man. He turned out to be a fighter. He was small for his age. He was picked on. And one time he was walking to school, and an older, larger kid named Arthur Storer beat him up, kicked him in the stomach. They went on to school, and Newton's sitting there in the, he's sitting in that little schoolhouse, and he's got to do something about this. He can continue getting beat up, or he could try to stop it. What to do. So what little Isaac Newton ends up doing is he challenges Arthur to a fight. He says, it's like, look, if I'm going to keep getting beat up if I don't do something about this. Now, kids, I'm not condoning any of this. And I want you all to sign here to show that I'm absolved of all responsibility. So what he ends up doing, so here's this little kid, and Arthur's like, oh, come on. As soon as it begins, you get Newton just unleashes on Arthur. Just ferocious. Beats Arthur. Just beats. Arthur's like, whoa. Doesn't know what to do with him. So he wins. But then the headmaster's son, he's like, look, and all the kids are gathered around, and the headmaster's son is like, I'm going to do a little, he wants to cause trouble. He goes, you know what? Arthur gave up. He's a coward. You need to treat him as such. And so this is definitely the part that I don't condone. Newton takes, I'm giving you a bad impression of this guy. Newton takes Arthur's face and rubs it across the church wall and just leaves this mark on him. And it says, and he's basically saying, look, do not mess with me. This is such it's such a little metaphor of Newton's life. Not that he becomes physically crazy and all. He ends up later, we have a list of his, when he's in college, he lists all these sins, just a huge list of sins. And one of them that he confesses is this fight with Arthur Storer. But what it does show is that Newton has this tendency to, he just does not want any trouble with anyone. He's, leave me alone. I don't want any trouble. And people will just push him. And they do this his whole life. And this is going to be, they're going to push him, saying that he cheated, or that he stole this idea from this other person, or this idea is stupid, and they won't leave him alone. And when he writes back, he will make sure that his point is made. He ends up being one of those, he's a very reluctant fighter, but then when he fights, he fights hard. That's just his personality. And his personality, and that's what comes out in when he's attacking a problem. And that's what he said when he's, you know, when he's discovering the fundamental laws of gravity, or he's inventing the calculus. When they asked him, well, how did you do these things? And he's like, look, it's not because I was so smart. I mean, all geniuses say that. He was certainly smart, but he goes, it's because I would think on it continually. What he would do is he once a problem, an intellectual problem, hit him and it grabbed him, he would not rest. That ferocity that came, that he showed, you know, physically as a little kid, ended up showing itself in a different way when he was older. And he was a maniac when it came to, and I mean, he accomplished so much that it's astounding that one person could do so much. And it was because he was so intense. He would forget to sleep. He would not eat. He was intense. So anyways, he's just one of those interesting folks. I mean, it's funny to see, you know, you have these, we're all flawed. And you see on the one hand, Newton has, I mean, he's just this, ends up being this godly man. And at the same time, he's kind of a little strange in these other areas too. And God ends up using that strangeness as well. God seems to like to draw straight with crooked lines. Okay, so you have this really intense kid. But at the time, when he had around that time when he was fighting when he fought Arthur, he wasn't a studier at all. He out of 80 students in the school, he was 79th. And they ranked them in how they ranked the students was they would put the A kids up front and the F kids in the back. So Newton is way in the back. Arthur was in front of him. And so he said, this isn't over. I'm going to beat this guy in here too. And so what ends up doing, it sparks in him this motivation to study, and ends up what he does is he moves up from the very back all the way to the front over time. He carves his name in every desk on the way up and ends up going to the front, and that's where he stays. So he needed something dramatic to push him. Actually, most boys need something dramatic to push them. I speak from experience. But something got him going. Now, if he hadn't had that fight, he may have ended up being a farmer, just like his dad, which is great. It just, he wouldn't have done the things that he did. So there's a big change. Even these little events, these apparently little events in lives, can make a huge difference. Okay. So that, I'm just giving you some of my favorite parts about Newton. I mean, that intensity I like a lot, because I also know that when he grows up, he ends up being a very godly man. And it's kind of nice to see, he gives me hope. It's like, okay, you can grow and become more Christ-like. But now when it comes to this notion of, you know, when Newton is brought up, you know, here he is a scientist. Surely he must have been an unbeliever. You know, he's right around the time of the Enlightenment. Actually, what it was, he's the reason for the Enlightenment. I wish I could go into that more, but really Newton is the reason that we had the Enlightenment of the 1700s. But let me tell you, this is one of the things that Newton is so critical to understanding the history of the West. That, I mean, here's two things. I'll just say this as an aside. We should know we should be studying Newton, no doubt. But here's my dream. By the time students are out of high school, everyone, at least anybody who can do basic algebra, should have studied calculus. Now, not the way calculus is normally taught. Calculus is normally taught now in a horrific way. But how it should be taught, we should absolutely understand how calculus is this culmination of the Greek project and how it's evidence for design. There's a lot that goes into, not just so you can know how to solve calculus problems. But this is so critical. And what's so sad about it is that that's such a crazy notion. It's like, really, calculus for everybody? That's crazy talk. That just shows how far we have to go. So let me tell you give you just the central story of why Newton is important. And it goes all the way back to Greek philosophy. It goes back to, you guys have heard of Plato. Very important Greek philosopher. Someone once said that all Western philosophy is but a footnote to Plato. Okay, this was the man. Okay, when you think of Plato, think about, if you have to put a time on, a date, say roughly 400 BC. That's just a good rough hand, 400 BC. Now, Plato actually was taught by the Pythagoreans. Probably the only place you know Pythagoras is from the Pythagorean theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared, right triangle stuff. Here's the thing. When Pythagoras, and at least the Pythagoreans, are the reason we have mathematical physics today. I mean, these guys are so, they're so central to it all. I mean, it's really amazing. But anyways, here's what the Pythagoreans thought. They thought, and this was a wacky idea, that the world was fundamentally mathematical. That everything was made of numbers, there's evidence that they thought things literally made of numbers. Not just things were mathematical, but the world, the cosmos, was made of numbers. All is number was their almost their religious creed. Okay? Now, Plato studied under these guys. Plato ends up thinking the same thing. The world, the cosmos, is fundamentally mathematical. I mean, it's just like a math. It's like, if you don't like math, the history of philosophy is a nightmare. I mean, these guys, the most important philosopher in history. Okay, so maybe he's not the most important philosopher in history. I like being corrected on the fly like that. That's, and by God. What shall I do? So you have Plato, I mean, just with mathematics on the mind, on the brain. And it's funny because you usually think of philosophy as opposed to math and science. Those are kind of the two things. And that's not how it really ever was traditionally. Math, science, and philosophy were this three-stranded cord. Now, everything was mathematical. It was crazy. And here's what Plato said. He had this. He had a school. He was head of a school called the Academy. And the Academy, they said that over the archway, the entrance, it said, "Let no one ignorant of geometry enter here." And for them, by that time, and this is a fun story that I won't tell you, is geometry was actually all of mathematics. You're probably thinking, how could that be a fun story? But it is. All of mathematics was seen as geometry. So basically what Plato's academy said is, look, if you want to do philosophy, then you better know math. In fact, the seven liberal arts, I love it when the thunder punches, makes that emphasis. The seven liberal arts, the first three, the trivium, right? Grammar, rhetoric, and logic. What about the four? The quadrivium. The quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music, or harmonics. That was the Pythagorean designation for all of mathematics. So, what, 4/7, if I remember how to do math, 4/7 of the liberal arts is math. If you're educating your kids classically, if you know anything about that, that's kind of a shocker. Whoa, 4/7. Anyways, this is important stuff, and it goes to the heart of what. It goes to the heart of Western intellectual history. In any event, Plato thought that math was important. And he had this homework problem for his academy. He says, look, guys, here's what I want you to do. You see the cosmos? You know, all the stars and the planets and moon and all of that. It looks pretty chaotic now. I want you to find a mathematical model of that cosmos. I want you to describe that mathematically. Now, you might think, well, that's pretty simple. It just looks like, you know, you just have this wheel going around. But it's actually not. When you look at the actual path of the planets and the sun and all over the course of years, or, you know, even weeks and months, they're not well behaved at all. You'll get planets, if you watch them over months, they go through the sky and then they reverse and then they go back again. The sun sets at different places on the horizon. It's very complicated what Plato is saying is, look, see that drunk guy? I want you to figure out his path, his drunken path, with math. I mean, that seems, he wants to take all of this complicated mess and make it nice and neat. There's no reason to think that that's a possibility. I mean, we do it now and we think, yeah, we use math all the time. But the only reason that we use math, you know, that we think, yeah, of course, that's just what physicists do. We just describe the world mathematically and that's it. That is not a natural idea. That's unnatural. It should not work. And it should not work in a world where there's no designer. If there were no designer, if this was just, you know, we're here by chance, to think that math would tell us anything about the world is absolutely contrary to all that you would believe. Anyways, that's a different issue. So Plato sets up this homework problem, and it becomes the problem for physics. That's basically it. Describe the world, describe the cosmos. By the way, cosmos means order. It's the opposite of chaos. So you have chaos and cosmos. Just the fact that these guys thought that it was orderly and, you know, that it wasn't a chaos is something big. We'll see that current atheists, they believe that they believe in order. They believe that math should work. And it's not so clear that it should. Okay. Now, Plato has a student, a very famous student. His name is Aristotle. Aristotle wasn't that big on mathematics. His father was a physician. He was much more interested in biology. He ends up kind of shifting some of the physics away, some of the science away from mathematics and into more of a biological realm. So you start thinking of the cosmos as having, remember what we saw, they had natures, these internal motivations or causes that make objects behave the way they do, make an object fall towards the center of the earth. That's not a mathematical description. It's this metaphysical cause. So what you have from here on out is kind of these two strains where you have the astronomers who do math and the philosophers who do Aristotelian physics and want to know about natures. So the mathematicians and the scientists don't come together yet. And that lasts for about 2,000 years until the 1600s. And you know what happens in the 1600s, right? That was the scientific revolution. So here we're back to the scientific revolution. This is another way that, another reason this is so important. And remember what I said, the scientific revolution is an overthrowing of whom? You guys remember? Yeah, Aristotle. So what you have from Aristotle all the way up to the 1600s is you have this minority of mathematicians, you know, making calendars and, you know, with basket of kittens on them. No, they're making calendars to figure out festivals and Easter and all of that, and they're doing their math. And then you have the main core of scientists who are the philosophers. They are the Aristotelians. The mathematicians were called the astrologers. That's where you have Augustine railing against mathematicians. You have people mocking Augustine. Look, this guy, he was saying that the mathematicians were evil. Well, he was using the word for mathematicians. He was talking about astrologers and them doing astrology, because a lot of times they were the same folk. So, two strains. The main stream was the Aristotelian philosophers, the scientists. Then you had this minority of the astrologers and the mathematicians and the astronomers. They were not usually the same people. Aristotle's on the throne in the 1600s. Galileo comes along. Remember him? Galileo comes along and says, look, let's start using mathematics instead of natures. Natures are kind of spooky. Who knows? I mean, he didn't say that there weren't any, but he said, look, I don't think we can know about those just yet. Let's do the math thing. So it's like all of a sudden Galileo brings back the Platonic Pythagorean tradition. In fact, get this. The Pythagoreans believed that the sun was at the center of the universe. So when they're talking about, when Galileo talks about Copernicanism and the sun being at the center, do you know what they call it oftentimes? They didn't call it Copernicanism so much. They called it the Pythagorean view. So there really was, around this time, when people say, you know what, Aristotle, you got to go. We're going to overthrow you. What they're doing is they're taking different ideas, some of the ideas from Plato. It's almost like nothing is new under the sun. So they're taking ideas from Plato in the Pythagoreans and saying, look, we need more mathematics back in the sciences. But here's the problem. There's a lot of movement in the cosmos. Everything's always moving. The stars, everything changes, everything moves, nothing remains the same. You've got, it just seems like there's motion everywhere. And you know what? That's very hard to describe mathematically. In fact, speed, just the concept of speed that we think we understand so well, is so very complicated. It required a whole new mathematics. So what you have is you have Newton, and then we're getting to Newton. Newton becomes very interested in a lot of these issues, these traditional issues of motion and all of that, but he's also interested in the mathematical side. Because he's learned from Galileo, not directly, but now there's this, hey, look, we need mathematics back. But doggone it, there's no mathematics that's good enough. We don't have a mathematics that's powerful enough to do what we want it to do. Hey, I know, I'll invent calculus. Voila, I'll invent calculus and then use calculus to come up with fundamental, to unlock the fundamental secrets of the cosmos in just an afternoon. So this is what Newton does, not in an afternoon. Newton ends up inventing a new mathematics, the calculus. Calculus, if you don't learn anything about calculus ever in your life other than this, make sure it's this. Calculus is the mathematics of motion. The mathematics of motion or change. It's the way we are able to latch on to the world of speed and acceleration and motion. Okay? Which means falling objects and planets, movements of planets and all of that. But it needs something dramatic like the calculus. So, here's what happens. Newton ends up taking the Pythagorean tradition, you know, of math, the world's mathematical, and that it should be described mathematically. Same with Plato. Takes Plato's homework, and he ends up turning. He's basically the one who first turns in the homework. But he does so in a way that would have blown the Pythagoreans and the Platonists' minds. They would never have imagined that it would have been done so well and so completely. I mean, not that he, you know, not that there's nothing left to do or anything like that, but the strides that Newton made in just his short lifetime, amazing. And basically what he does is he fulfills that Greek dream that has been the center of Greek philosophy since even before Plato. So it's like, wow, Newton, the scientist, is really standing in the line of philosophers. And again, science, especially at this time, was philosophy. Science and philosophy were the same thing. And now mathematics had come back into it. Again, I'll just plant this seed. Just keep this in mind for future generations to start moving to the point where we really are teaching all of our kids enough calculus to understand this story. Because it really does, you really can't see the history of Western philosophy in its proper perspective unless you understand at least a little bit of what's going on with calculus. And I think that's a wonderful thing. You know, all of God's truth is one, and so it shouldn't surprise us that math has something to do with philosophy, which has something to do with literature, which has something, you know, they're all connected. You should be, you know, we want our kids to be able to go from talking about car engines to Shakespeare without changing the subject. Right? They just, the train of thought, you connect it all. And that's what we want. Okay, now here's what Newton does. He's got, you've heard of Newton's law of gravity. What it does is it's a mathematical equation that describes gravity. That's all you need to know about it. But what it does is it says that it gives you a mathematical law that governs an object that you drop here on Earth and an object that's going around the sun. The same equation, roughly, with qualifiers. But the same equation. And so here's the thing. Do you remember there were two realms in Aristotle's cosmos? The earthly realm and the heavenly realm made of ether that was spooky and mysterious? Well, they both had two separate laws of physics. Now there was just one. Man, Newton simplified everything and showed that there is so much order to the cosmos, even in that one equation. So he seals the deal when it comes to getting rid of those two realms. You're done. I mean, it's one world. That sounds like Bob Marley. It's one world in the sense that you have one set of laws to govern the entire cosmos. By the way, Newton, when you hear about Newton, a lot of times you'll think this was before I really got to know Newton. What I had always heard about him was he was the starter of basically atheism, scientific atheism, and a mechanical kind of a clockwork-like universe. So everything's all, just it fits together and it's like a machine. And then, if God is needed for anything, he's just needed to wind up the clock. And that's it. And it's just like Newton was the whole start of that and is just downhill from there. What's really weird is that Newton, this new Newtonian clock-like universe, mechanical means gears and forces on bodies that are touching each other and pushing and pulling. Actually, Newton's gravity was nothing like that at all. It was this real, I think it was Einstein said, spooky action at a distance. It's like one object over here and one object over here, and they somehow affect one another without coming into contact or without having any sort of connection. There's no radiation or anything for Newton. It was this weird action at a distance. And man, the philosophers did not like that. They're like, Newton, you're going back to that old, all the natures and all the weirdness. They actually called it the occult. They thought that gravity was the, like, Newton, your gravity, man, it's like you're going back to the occult powers, these hidden powers. So it's funny that Newton is now associated with this mechanical view when he really had a super spooky view, mysterious, non-mechanical view. Now, why would anyone think that Newton is an atheist? Here's why. Here's what Newton did. Notice, so he's unlocked some of the secrets of the universe with mathematics, right? Mathematics. What's the main tool that humans use when they're doing mathematics? Reason, their mind. I mean, you need pencils and sometimes just to keep your memory straight and all of that, but it's a mental exercise. Mathematics is reason personified. So what Newton has done is he's shown that human reason can unlock these secrets. And they've associated this unlocking of secrets with an overturning of what the Bible says about the cosmos. Namely, the earth doesn't move and all that. So you have this association. They think scientific revolution, which means an overthrowing of religious authority. Well, who did that? Who was the one who ultimately did that? Well, it was Newton who ends up being on the throne. How did he do it? He did it using reason. So he dies in 1727. So he's dying. So from about 1700 on, you get people going, yay, Newton, yay, reason. You even get, and especially you'll get this because Voltaire was a big fan of Newton. I think that's another reason, too, people associate Newton with atheism is because Voltaire was someone who admired him and was actually a Newtonian apologist kind of for the continent, for Europe. And then David Hume, he was another atheist, another philosopher who loved Newton. And so what you have is you have this guilt by association. But notice what it is. It's reason has unlocked the secrets. Man's reason can do this. There were even during the... There was someone in France around, you know, sometime in the 1700s, I think, that wanted to start a church around Newton. Like, that was going to be their religion. And they certainly, you know, and it comes to the French Revolution and all, you know, they wanted to take down, the churches, start to change them over to be shrines to reason. And all of it was looking back at Newton and what he did with reason. Now, I haven't seen anything in here that has once said that reason is contrary to anything, contrary to belief in God or anything. Newton certainly didn't see it. Many Christians who were scientists after him haven't seen it. But here's the thing, you need to see that the Enlightenment, which is what atheists, and we'll talk about this later, atheists today say, look, we need a new Enlightenment. Well, the Enlightenment they associate with Newton. But here's the thing, Newton is not antithetical to religion. You know, the originator of modern science, the Newtonian worldview, was a devout Christian. You need to understand his importance and that it was a Christian importance. I mean, I think that's, we just go team, right? I mean, we need to know what our team does. But also, we need to see that the principles were not contrary to belief in God. In fact, and we'll see this later, they required, perhaps, a belief in God. Okay, so that's just more of a historical view. We've talked about Galileo and about Newton and a little bit about the scientific revolution. You need to understand that. Now what we're going to do in the following two lectures is to bring it a little closer to home in the sense more contemporary, talk about more general ideas and about unbelief in particular. Is there anything I need to say about the lunch or anything we're ready?
Sure.
Are we going to?
Yeah, sure. I'll ask you.